America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. How are our kids doing? Our young people. And there's a fascinating and lengthy piece in the New York Times that says young people are more educated, they're less likely to get pregnant, to use drugs, less likely to die of accident or injury, said Candace Odgers, who's a psychologist at University of California, Irvine. By many markers, kids are doing fantastic and thriving, but there are these really important trends in anxiety, depression, and suicide that stop us in our tracks. Her piece that, in which she's quoted in the New York Times, goes on to talk about a 60% growth in suicide, and higher than that in terms of suicidal ideation. Young people, perhaps as many as 1 out of 4 who actually think about suicide or hurting themselves. Also addressing this issue in an important paper, which we have put up on our website, michaelmedved.com, has been a previous guest on our show, Erica Komisar, who is a psychoanalyst, a parent guidance expert, and the author of Chicken Little, The Sky Isn't Falling, Raising Resilient Adolescents in the New Age of Anxiety. You make the important point, Erica, that in your piece that these negative trends started long before the pandemic. Why?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on again, Michael. And yes, COVID, I would say COVID was an amplifier of trends that were already happening. I mean, I wrote the book that I wrote well before this pandemic, and it was already an issue. I mean, certainly the rates of suicide, I mean, one reason I wrote this piece that just came out in the Institute for Family Studies was because the suicide statistics just came out, and during COVID, in that two-year period of 20 to 22, the rates yet rose again and more intensely. So we do know that COVID amplified what was already happening, which is that there was already a mental health crisis with children and adolescents in the United States.
And when you look at this, this cuts across racial and even economic educational lines. Mm-hmm. Is there any group or subheading in the United States among our teenagers that seems to be less subject to this terrible trend right now?
Well, I mean, some of the groups where there's research on it are, you could say they're more a little bit more inoculated are adolescents who have some connection to faith, where their families actually, celebrate and, attend services. There was a Harvard study that said that kids who attend religious services, at least once a week and really participate in some faith, and didn't mention which faith, any faith, were inoculated. They did better in terms of their mental health. And from my perspective as a clinician, it's when parents are really physically and emotionally available to their adolescents and really interested in their adolescents that is sort of an inoculation as well. So physical and emotional presence and understanding both the neurological challenges and the emotional challenges of their adolescents so they can really kind of help to regulate their emotions.
In your piece for the Institute for Family Studies, mm-hmm. you point out that the right brain, the prefrontal cortex, mm-hmm. along with the limbic system, is the emotionally regulating part of the brain. Mm. And it's not fully developed until age 25.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning that, would you consider, for the purposes of this discussion, young people up to the age of 25 to be adolescents?
Yes. So adolescence actually begins at 9 and ends at 25. It begins with puberty, and it ends with the when the right brain and the prefrontal cortex is really developed, and that's not until 25. And I think Dan Siegel in his book, he called it all gas and no brakes until you're about 25, which means that there are so many parts of the brain, the reward center and the stress regulating center of the brain, that are overdeveloped. It's kind of a dissonance or discrepancy between brain development, that they're overdeveloped, and the prefrontal cortex, which is the regulating part of the brain, is kind of underdeveloped, is chasing those parts of the brain to catch up. And it's not until 25 that they all come together.
So during, if you have a young person in your home who's right mm-hmm. in that stretch of growth between age 9 and 25, mm-hmm. what are some of the most important things that parents or guardians should keep in mind to keep those young people safe?
Well, I mean, I think it's really important to be attuned to any changes in your child's mood, any changes in your child's behavior. You know, what we know is that adolescents aren't always as communicative as we'd like, and so we have to look not just for what they say, but also for how they seem and their nonverbal behaviors. And you know, the idea is that suicidal threats are an expression of unhappiness, but they're an expression of losses, of past trauma or current trauma, of stress in the family dynamics, of social and academic pressures. And, you know, the more involved we are, not in an intrusive way, but just in a healthy way, the more interested and involved we are in their lives, the more we know when they have challenges, and when we see that they're reacting to those challenges, being as attuned as possible. And, you know, there's a lot about parenting, Michael, that has changed for the good. There's also a lot that's changed not for the good. The part that's changed for the good is that parents are more psychological in general today, meaning they are more interested not in being those old-fashioned, judgmental, punitive, disciplinarian parents, but they're more interested in being sensitive and empathic and wanting to understand their children's behavior. That's really what will help us in the long run to conquer this crisis.
You also say in your piece that it's important, part of what happened during the pandemic is kids were having less chance to interact with their peers.
Yes.
Face-to-face, and we're spending more time on social media. And what is the most important message parents can give their kids about the immersion in social media that's part of their lives?
Well, I mean, and there was a real increase. I think 61%, there's just a study that came out to say that during COVID, adolescents used social media 61% more, and it was already too much. The best thing we can do is regulate it from the moment we give them a smartphone or we give them access to a computer, because if you try to regulate it later, it's harder, like anything, right? If you don't teach them good regulation from the beginning, it's not impossible. You can still regulate it, but it's harder. So you want to really create structure from the beginning. And what I tell parents is that if you can, particularly with younger adolescents, to not let them have the social media apps till the last possible time that you can give it to them, meaning, you know, wait till 14 at least if you can. Put them off till 14.
And you also make the point that parents should try to send the message that not the view of the world that you get from social media is not always entirely accurate or representative. That's also a theme in your book, Chicken Little, The Sky Isn't Falling, Raising Resilient Adolescents in the New Age of Anxiety. Erica, appreciate your contribution. We've posted this paper up at michaelmedved.com. We will be right back. On the Michael Medved Show, talking about the upcoming horizon in terms of the election of 2022. It does appear that despite the fact that there is an attempt to issue subpoenas which are going to be defied against five Republican leaders in Congress, this as part of the investigation of what happened on January 6th. The idea that this issue is actually going to play out to prevent the very likely Republican takeover of the House of Representatives, it seems that that is going to be going forward. Now, there's news today on Ron DeSantis. We've been talking about him. He had signed a reapportionment plan that he had substituted for a legislative plan, which he vetoed. It was supposed to be guaranteed to gain four seats for Republicans in terms of reapportionment and redistricting in Florida. Well, that's now been put on hold by a federal judge, and it may mean that in two of the nation's most competitive and most significant states, with battles coming up on governorships and on the Senate seats and more, that in both Florida and New York, they don't have a definite date for primaries. They are pushing them back and back because they can't reach agreement and they can't reach court approval with some of the attempts at redistricting. There's also this on the battle for the Senate, which is utterly crucial, where there are so many close elections. The National Republican Senate Committee is reserving 53 million in ads in top battleground states through the November elections. That's a figure substantially larger than the Democratic counterpart, the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee. That is doing an initial ad buy of 33 million as opposed to 53 million for the year. And by the way, the Republicans are spending much more than they did 2 years ago in 2020, where despite Trump's loss in the presidential election, and yes, he lost and he lost the popular vote, et cetera, in terms of the voting for the members of Congress, members of the House of Representatives, Republicans actually gained seats in that election. This election campaign, they're spending 20 million more, which is a great deal of money when you think about it. The they're reserving 9.5 million in Georgia, 9 million in Wisconsin to reelect Ron Johnson, 9 million in New Hampshire, which is a small state. That means they are treating New Hampshire as a particular target, the Republicans, 8 million in Arizona, 8 million in Pennsylvania, 6.5 million in North Carolina, and 3 million in Nevada. That's all a great deal of money. The expectation is that a problem that had existed clearly before with a lack of Democratic enthusiasm for voting and the likelihood of a low Democratic turnout, they're trying to address that through a fairly hysterical rhetoric concerning abortion. And so much so that this is typical of what you're hearing from the Democratic leadership. Chuck Schumer, who is struggling to return as majority leader, has this to say. He is blaming a breed known as MAGA Republicans for the entire abortion issue. This is clip 10.
Let me make a brief statement. Now, the vote we just took, makes crystal clear the contrast between the parties as we approach the midterm elections. Vote, elect more pro-choice Democrats if you want to see a woman have control over her own body. Elect more pro-choice Democrats if you want to protect a woman's freedom and right to choose. Elect more MAGA Republicans if you want to see a nationwide ban on abortion, if you want to see doctors and women arrested, if you want to see no exceptions for rape or incest.
Okay, basically the entire term MAGA Republicans, it would seem to me that given some of the misuse of the questions about the election of 2020, the fact that many so-called MAGA Republicans are just obsessed with that, that Schumer would want those people to be the nominees he would be running against. But that's not at all clear. And Joe Scarborough, who is no friend of MAGA Republicans or MAGA anything, obviously, is very clear from his perspective. He actually ripped Senate Democrats because of their virtue signaling with scheduling this entirely symbolic abortion rights vote where they knew that it had no chance of passage or getting the 60 votes it would have needed to, let alone the 51 votes it would have needed for a majority, not even close to the 60 votes they would have needed to go forward because of the threat of filibuster. Here's what he said about virtue signaling and the Democrats, 17A.
The story of this Democratic Congress thus far is wildly overshooting the mark and getting nothing from it.
Well, they want to show where people stand.
Yeah,
starkly.
You know, the time for virtue signaling is over.
Just saying that was the
they
point.
Don't have many legislative days left.
Look, I think that's quite reasonable. And why do they have not many legislative days left to waste? He goes on to talk about the issues where they just have refused to compromise or work with the other side. Listen.
You know, they could go to Joe Manchin and say, we need a $1.75 trillion bill. Because Joe Manchin said, I'll give you a $1.75 trillion bill. And nobody ever says this, because they always like sticking horns on Joe Manchin, who, by the way, Democrats should all like send him a box of chocolate, perhaps, for standing in the way of a $6 trillion bill, flooding this inflation-torn economy with a $6 or $3 trillion bill. But he said, other $1.75 trillion bill, but let's reverse the Trump tax cuts, right? That sounds like a good idea if you're a Democrat. Let's take care of the insulin fix. That sounds like a good idea if you're a Democrat. But no, it's never enough. And it's just like the Electoral Count Act. The Wall Street Journal and the New York Times editorial pages both said, let's get rid of this Electoral Count Act of 1887 if we want to avoid what happened on January the 6th, if we want to avoid that next January the 6th. Democrats, no, doesn't go far enough. Democrats are left with nothing, and they're running out of time.
I think that's extremely wise and extremely on point. There's also a revelation about another crisis the country is encountering. Is it crime? Is it inflation? Something else, but very serious. We'll get to that coming up on the MedVed Show.
Here's a question for you. Why is it that some people aren't...
Daily dose of debate.
Debated with a lot of people. I've never debated with anyone nearly as good as you.
Michael Medved.
You're a masterful speaker.
You want to try me out? I appreciate those kind words from the past. 1-800-955-1776 is our phone number. Just yesterday, we were talking about a new numbers that were released by the Centers for Disease Control about the level of crime, particularly of gun deaths in the United States. And now there's this about a significantly more costly, in terms of human life, development in this country that has been just announced by the CDC. Headline, overdose deaths hit record levels, with fentanyl a key culprit. After a catastrophic increase in 2020, deaths from drug overdoses rose again to record-breaking levels in 2021, nearing 100 and 8,000. That's 108,000 people who've died from drug overdoses. It's the result of an ever-worsening fentanyl crisis, according to preliminary new data published yesterday by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The increase of nearly 15% followed an even steeper rise of almost 30% in 2020, an unrelenting crisis that has consumed federal and state drug policy officials since the 1970s. The number of drug overdose deaths has increased every year except 2018. A growing share of deaths continue to come from overdoses involving fentanyl, a class of potent synthetic opioids that are often mixed with other drugs, and methamphetamines, a synthetic stimulant. State health officials battling an influx of both drugs said many of the deaths appear to be the result of combining the two. Deaths involving synthetic opioids, largely fentanyl, rose to 71,000 from 58,000, while those associated with stimulants like methamphetamine, which has grown cheaper and more lethal in recent years, increased to 33,000 from 25,000. Because fentanyl is a white powder, it can be easily combined with other drugs, including opioids like heroin and stimulants like meth and cocaine, and can be stamped into counterfeit pills for anti-anxiety drugs like Xanax, and such mixtures can prove lethal if drug users are unaware they are taking fentanyl or unsure of the dose. Look, I'm not sure that people are nearly careful enough with what they are taking. And one of the films that we're going to be reviewing tomorrow is an insider Hollywood comedy, which talks about a bunch of people trying to finish a monster movie in the series. It's about people fighting dinosaurs, and it has had the same cast for a bunch of previous films, and now they're coming back. The film's called The Bubble. It's by Judd Apatow, who's a very major, successful comedy director of a 40-year-old virgin and Funny People and many, many other films. And there's a scene where they all relax by taking drugs. And it's portrayed as fun because they all get hyper and they're dancing and they're having a great time. And look, this is appallingly irresponsible, because I'm not saying that people are going to go out and immediately imitate what they see on screen. That's not the issue. The issue is regularizing this. The idea right now, the Biden administration has just empowered a brand new task force to try to deal with these overdose problems. And yes, it's been appropriate. We have sued some of the big providers, the big corporate forces that have helped to promote some of this, the opioid distribution, which has been so terrible for the country. The White House in recent weeks, writes the New York Times, in recent weeks announced President Biden's first national drug control strategy, and a plan to combat meth use was unveiled last week by his drug czar, Dr. Rahul Gupta, the first medical doctor to oversee the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy. Overdose deaths involving meth almost tripled between 2015 and 2019 in people 18 to 64. That, according to the National Institutes of Health, it is unacceptable that we are losing a life to overdoses every 5 minutes around the clock, Dr. Gupta said in his statement yesterday. Look, part of the difficulty here is that a great deal of focus has gone forward to naloxone, to various antidotes that they can use to help prevent the damaging impact of overdoses. But it seems to me that the real focus ought to be combating addiction and combating the availability of these drugs. And basically, I know people say, oh, the war on drugs, it wasn't worth anything. It was a complete waste of money. It did no good. Actually, the war on drugs had tremendous success reducing the epidemic of crack cocaine, which had fed the homicide rate. And some of the successes that we had in the 90s in particular in terms of bringing down the homicide rates had to do with the reduction in some of the drug use, particularly with crack cocaine. And now, basically, to see this, and with the government facing so many other problems, almost seeing this as a subsidiary issue, if you lost 108,000 people, if every five minutes there's another death from a drug overdose, it does seem to me it's more appropriate to take it seriously. Also, taking it seriously, we have new news on the space program, a probe that will land on Saturn's moon Enceladus. Is one of the priorities outlined in a new report for NASA. A robotic mission to orbit Uranus, a probe that could land on a potentially life-supporting moon of Saturn, and a better plan for astronauts to do high-quality science on the moon. They're talking about a trip to Uranus, which is a very far distance. Unlike rocky planets like Mars and gas giants like Jupiter, the ice giants Uranus and Neptune have never been studied with a dedicated mission to orbit and study them. Part of the reason for that will take about 15 years to travel that distance, even at rocket speed. You'll pardon the expression. Uranus is the seventh planet from the sun. It has only ever been visited by NASA's Voyager 2 probe, which flew by in 1986, coming within, about 50,000 miles. In recent years, detections of planets in alien solar systems show that ice giant planets are, quote, likely the most common class of planets in the universe. Great. And we saw this mission as delivering absolutely transformative breakthrough science because we know so little about these systems. By the way, it would cost about $4 billion to make this journey, and the idea of it being privately supported, and you're giving 15 years to travel to Uranus. There's also a moon of Saturn that is the logical candidate to grow to try to look for evidence of life today. Why? We'll get to that on the MedVed Show. Michael Medved Show. I did want to mention this $5.4 billion extra that NASA is hoping to receive, and not for 1 year. That's to be spent over a number of years. And that's to voyage to Uranus, to a moon of Neptune, which they think is particularly promising, and more. And the space exploration usually does have strong support. They are saying here in this piece at NPR, the National Public Radio, in recent years, detections of planets in alien solar systems show that ice giant planets are likely the most common class of planets in the universe. And we saw this mission. They're talking about a mission they sent up to Uranus before and flew by in 1986. As delivering absolutely transformative breakthrough science because we know so little about these systems, we are sure there are going to be lots of surprises once we get there. And Enceladus, which is one of Saturn's moons, is another scientifically compelling destination. It is thought to have an ocean of liquid water under an icy crust, just like Europa. But this moon sends plumes of that material out into space, making it easier to obtain samples that originated deep within. The new report recommends sending a probe that could arrive there in the early 2050s, in other words, 30 years from now, land on the surface, and search for evidence of life in fresh plume material that rains down on it. Enceladus is the logical candidate to go try to look for evidence of life today, says one of the spokesmen for NASA. In terms of the ocean worlds, it's by far the most active and the easiest to access. And look, this is one of those things that they are talking about going back to the moon. They're talking about going back to Mars. And these developments scientifically are just to satisfy human curiosity and to answer some key questions about the universe we live in seem to me very compelling. And there was a lot of talk about this idea of somebody, like, think Elon Musk, if he gets bored with Twitter, he could go ahead and buy himself a seat on the 15-year trip to Uranus. But not very likely. They're talking about using robotic flights. It is cheaper and easier. Yeah, maybe we get Putin to volunteer particularly for a trip to Uranus, where they don't think it's going to be particularly successful in sustaining life. Speaking of Putin and the President of the United States, President Bush had apparently a very good conversation with President Zelensky, not with Vladimir Putin. Remember, he made that stupid comment, George W. Bush, that he looked into Putin's eyes and actually wanted to trust him and work with him. McCain, I think it was, who said that. He said, I've looked into Putin's eyes, too, and I just see three letters, KGB. In any event, President Biden talked about fighting on two fronts. And basically, he is clearly and increasingly in some of his public statements looking for sympathy and not for enthusiastic support. This is clip 15.
Right now, America is fighting on two fronts. At home, it's inflation and rising prices. Abroad, it's helping Ukrainians defend their democracy and feeding those who are left hungry around the world because Russian atrocities exist. And Jeff and the American farmers understand Putin's war has cut off critical sources of food.
Okay, this is one of the ironies of this particular war, is that Ukraine was at one time known as the breadbasket of Europe, and now there is reasons. They obviously do not have great crops. It's tough to bring those crops in when you have missiles dropping on your head all the time, and this has caused profound hardship in nations in Africa that depend on Ukrainian crops, and particularly wheat and other crops of that nature. And then President Biden had this to say about America in the Trump years, which is outrageous. Listen, this is clip 7.
Remember those long lines you'd see in a television? People lining up in all kinds of vehicles just to get a box of food in their trunk. How quickly we forget. People were hurting. And what did the MAGA crowd want to do? Forget it. Forget it. God, this is the United States of America. The idea that people would have to wait in line an hour and a half to get a box of food in their trunk. It's just unbelievable.
And what about the hardships now of people getting food and paying for it? And the problem with baby formula, I hope they solve the baby formula soon. There is all kinds of information that suggests that part of this has to do with the recall of baby formula by Abbott Pharmaceuticals that had to happen because they had had four babies, literally out of millions who had refused who had received the formula, who got sick from it, and you don't want that. Okay, one of the most acclaimed animated films of recent years has been a big new Pixar movie, which has got all kinds of strange references to different elements of the human journey. It's about a Canadian, Chinese heritage young lady coming to terms with her maturity. It's called Turning Red. Listen.
Now it's time for MedVed's Entertainment Minute.
An adorable 13-year-old Chinese-Canadian girl is transformed into a giant red panda whenever she gets too excited in the latest from Disney Pixar, Turning Red. Now available on Blu-ray.
Is everything okay?
I'm a gross red monster!
It happened already?
What did you say?
This odd and original film has drawn considerable acclaim for its focus on early adolescent girls coping with the complexity of periods, coming of age, and parental relations. But despite its PG rating, the appropriateness for small children is dubious at best, and the cultural and ideological messages suggesting that friendships are ultimately more important than family connections will provide grounds for debate, but not much in the way of cinematic fun. In the long tradition of brilliantly animated Pixar pictures, Turning Red stands out more for its complex content than its creative genius. 2.5 stars for the audacious Turning Red. And on the Michael Medved Show, tomorrow we have a total of four big new movies. Two of them are very creepy, haunting. You'd think it was Halloween, but no, it's not. They are mysteries that actually can be very disturbing at points. Speaking of very disturbing, by the way, there are several news stories, and this concerning what we just played from President Biden. He's talking about the Trump years and what a shame it was, and people waiting in line for boxes of food at food banks. And several news stories from various cities across the country that have headlines like "Food Banks Struggle to Cope with Inflation and Increased Demand." And this has been the Biden era now for a year and a half, nearly. Okay, tomorrow we'll also talk about a strange trend in baby names, the comeback of 1980s grandma names. Why? Is America collapsing? That is a real question right now. There's so many people who seem to suggest that we are. It's the end of our empire. It's a parallel with the Roman Empire. There are a couple of commentators who make very strong rebuttals to those charges and suggest that things are better than we think in the land of the free. We will get to that. And after a million COVID deaths, why is it Americans are still confused about the virus and how to cope with it? More than 2 years into the pandemic, public health establishments still hasn't designed fully effective or credible mandates or given people the information they need most. That, and this is a attention getter, have scientists designed finally the perfect chocolate for this greatest nation on God's green earth?